cat. Just because I'm not feeling good, does that make me a member of your minority? That's only an outward indication, Fong said. The key element is whether or not you remember the events of that missing month. Old Chen decided to sound Fang Qiaodi out. Old Fang, have you been using some kind of drug for a long time, like maybe... So you are one of us, exclaimed Fang in surprise. Don't get so excited. Answer my question first, said Old Chen. Zhong Du and I both have chronic asthma, and we've been using corticosteroids for many years. Aha, exclaimed Old Chen. Don't say aha yet, said Fang. I did a survey and found that the great majority of people who take corticosteroids for their asthma don't fit into our small minority. To this day, I only know of myself and Zhang Du. Perhaps taking some other kind of drug might yield the same result, Old Chen suggested. What do you mean, Old Chen? Corticosteroids, antidepressants, painkillers, other analgesics? Old Chen went on speculating. Taking illegal drugs or some other type of medicine, maybe they all have this same effect. But not everyone who takes drugs or medicine for a long time will turn out this way. It's just that taking drugs or pills may increase the probability. And then we have to look at other variables. For example, what drug someone takes, or what someone's normal diet is, or personality, or just luck. All of these things could influence whether or not a person turns out that way. And so, what if you do? And if you are that way, firstly, you'll feel everyone around you has changed. Secondly, that so-called change will be that everyone around you has become happy and may even experience a constant small, small high. And thirdly, at least one part of the condition is that you will remember things that everyone else seems to have forgotten. Old Chen was thinking about how little Dong had remembered so much, while little Xi did not. That's it exactly, agreed Fang Qiaodi. We really are. Just like that. We can actually remember many things that other people have forgotten, especially the events of that lost month. That lost month. Old Chen finally got it. So what you've been saying is that a whole month has disappeared and been completely forgotten. Exactly. It's a case of collective amnesia. Which month exactly? Asked Old Chen, narrowing his eyes. It's precisely the month when the world economy went into crisis and China's golden age of ascendancy officially began, said Fang. Strictly speaking, it was in fact 28 days. Old Chen's mind wandered a bit as he recalled the detective novel 13 Months that he'd written at that time. Then regaining his composure, he asked, But didn't those two events occur at the same time? Not one after the other, with no gap in between. Old Chen, you're really funny, said Fang, laughing. Old Chen felt silent while he racked his brains trying to remember that period, but his memory was a complete blur. This whole thing might just be the result of Fang Qiaodi's overactive imagination. There might never have been any such lost 28 days. It seemed Fang Qiaodi had finally realized that Old Chen was not joking. Old Chen, you mean you really don't remember? But just now I actually thought you were one of us. Fang Qiaodi, Zhong Du, Little Xi and Little Dong. They're probably all members of that club, thought Old Chen. Well then, I'm sorry to have bothered you, said Fang disappointedly. No, Old Chen countered. I'm definitely not one of you, but listen. It's like this. You're aliens from outer space who have accidentally landed on Earth and can't go home. And I'm an Earthling who's able to communicate with you. I'm your friend on this Earth. Do you understand what I'm getting at? I get it, Fang said. You're a traitor among Earth people. Old Chen didn't feel like arguing any further. I know some people, more than one, who might be members of your club. That's terrific, said Fang. Where are they? I don't know where they are. I'm looking for one of them right now. Really? I'll help you. We can search together. Old Chen looked at Fang Qiaodi, trying to decide whether to let him tag along or whether, if he did, it would cause him any trouble.
I'm a specialist, Feng said. For the past couple of years, I've been working on this, looking for that lost month, looking for people like me for evidence. Let me help you, old Chen.
I'll think about it, old Feng. Feng Qiaodi felt silent for a moment, but just as they were reaching the Sanglian bookstore, he said,
Old Chen,
there's nothing worth reading in the bookstores these days. I've been all over the country, and it's the same everywhere. All they have are officially doctored books. Don't imagine you're going to find anything about the true state of things. If you don't believe me, take a look yourself. Not only are there no books that mention that lost month, there are definitely no books about the 1989 Tiananmen massacre. There aren't even any decent books about the anti-rightist campaign or the Cultural Revolution. They're all a pack of lies. Old Chen didn't respond. Feng Qiaodi was beginning to irritate the hell out of him. Do I need him to give me directions on how to browse in a bookstore, he thought. The Sangliang has thousands of books. Has Feng Qiaodi read them all? Even the memoirs of famous living people would fill up several rows of shelves. I used to come here every week, and I've come here every couple of months for the past 2 years. Am I not a lot better than him at finding books? I'm the expert here. Old Feng has always been such a pain in the arse. When Old Chen leapt out of the car as if to make his escape, Feng Qiaodi immediately dialed his number. Old Chen answered his ringing phone.
Now you've got my cell number. Ring me any time, 24/7. I'll be expecting your call.
And just before driving off, Feng leaned his head out the window.
Old Chen, I'll bet you they don't even sell books by someone as famous as Yang Jiang in there, and especially not her Cultural Revolution memoir.
With that, he drove off. Old Chen carried on ruminating. Besides those banned books published only in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and books printed illegally on the mainland by underground presses, many controversial books that were once legally published in China are definitely unavailable now, he thought to himself. Books like Little Shoes, the collection of CCP members' writings from 1941 to 1946, Harbingers of History, and Zhang Yihe's celebrated memoir of the anti-rightist campaign, The Past is Not a Fog. Yang Sanghui's 2003 report on the death by starvation of about 3,000 rightists in Gangsu, What Happened at Jiabianggou, and Wu Xi's Unwritten Rules, an expose of official corruption, might or might not be available. But bestsellers like Yang Jiang's The Shower, Six Chapters from My Life Down Under, and Reaching the Border of Human Life surely must be available. Baptism is even published by the Sanlian. How could they possibly not sell it? As soon as Old Chen entered the bookstore, he asked the sales assistant to look up Yang Jiang's works on the computer. Searching the screen, the assistant said, There aren't any. The young people of today really aren't very familiar with books, thought Old Chen. Are they out of stock?
There are no references here. Looks like we've never had them in.
Maybe you had them in a while ago.
There's no record of our ever having them.
But Baptism is a Sanlian publication.
Don't know about that. There's certainly no record on the computer.
Where's the manager?
Try the coffee shop on the second floor.
Old Chen was a fairly analytical person, and so he began to reflect on the fact that in the last 2 years, he hadn't read any eyewitness accounts of the history of the Chinese Communist Party or of the People's Republic. He hadn't even touched any memoirs of the anti-rightist campaign or the Cultural Revolution. He'd only read the classic Chinese novels, celebrated works in Chinese classical studies. For a while now, he'd been paying no attention to what non-fiction books and memoirs the Sanlian had on its shelves. He decided to go downstairs and take a good look. The basement had been redesigned. The section right by the stairs that had once held the Sanlian's own publications had been replaced by the fiction section. And next to it were sections on Chinese classical studies, religion, entertainment and popular media. Today, there were still plenty of customers in these areas, but their numbers didn't compare to the customers for bestsellers and business, self-improvement and travel books on the ground floor. Round the corner of the L-shaped basement, the customers thinned out even further. This was the philosophy, history and politics section, where Old Chen had felt so suffocated after the New Year reception.
Now his head ached like it was going to explode. So he quickly gave up his task and raced back up the stairs where the pounding gradually let up. He was looking for somewhere to sit down and hurried up to the second floor coffee shop. Olchen was thinking only of finding a nice secluded seat deep inside the coffee shop when he was surprised to hear someone call out, "Little Chen!" He turned his head and saw Jiang Zhizhong, the venerable founder of the Reading Journal, sitting there with the Sun Lian manager, a couple of vaguely familiar members of the cultural set, and a young woman. At the reading reception, Olchen hadn't greeted Jiang Zhizhong because of the number of people around him, but this time he couldn't escape. He felt particularly guilty as he shook Zhang's hand enthusiastically and said, "Master Zhang, I'm so happy to see you here." Jiang Zhizhong pointed to the young woman. "This is my wife, my present leadership," he said jokingly. "You've probably not met before."
"Mrs. Zhuang," Olchen gently shook her hand. "Call me Little Chen."
"Do you know each other?" Jiang Zhizhong asked his other companions, to which they all nodded. "I still have the clipping," Zhuang went on, "of when Little Chen interviewed me for Wing Bao. That was a quarter of a century ago." Everyone seemed pretty impressed. "Sit down, Little Chen," said Zhuang. "I have something I want to ask you. How did Ming Bao report this time on the central party leader's visit to my home?" The Ming Bao website was blocked on the mainland, and Old Chen had not seen the report, but he said anyway, "Oh, about the same as the report in the Beijing News, quite a big spread." Master Zhuang beamed. Old Chen could not help asking a question that had been playing on his mind. "Master Zhuang, is it true that intellectuals today are genuinely willing to be reconciled with the Communist Party?" He immediately felt he'd been too frank. "What do you mean?" Zhuang said, showing no adverse reaction to the question. "Are intellectuals willing to be reconciled with the Communist Party?" The question should be, "Is the party willing to be reconciled with intellectuals?" Just then, someone else came over to greet Jiang Zhizhong, and Old Chen took the opportunity to ask the Sun Lian manager, "Why don't you stock any of Yang Jiang's books?"
"Which Yang Jiang?" asked the manager.
"Chang Zhongzhu's wife, Yang Jiang."
"Oh," the manager said, as if he suddenly remembered. "You mean that Yang Jiang? Probably because nobody was buying her books."
Old Chen's head began to pound again. He hadn't read those kinds of books for a while himself, but did it mean that the tastes of the general public had changed too? Old Chen turned to Zhuang Zhizhong. "Master Zhuang, I have to leave now to attend to some business. It was wonderful to see you. Do take care of yourself." Then he turned to Mrs. Zhuang and said, "Take good care of Master Zhuang. He is a national treasure." As Old Chen left the Sun Lian bookstore, he was wondering if he'd been too ingratiating, if calling Zhuang Zhizhong a national treasure was a bit over the top. But then he remembered what the character Wei Xiaobo in Jing Yong's novel The Deer and the Cauldron always said. "Of all the things that can go wrong, flattery will never go wrong. What's it matter if you make other people happy?"
Welcome to this third season of Telno Show. Telno Show is an ongoing series of programs in which we ask an artist to present to us a piece of art that has had an impact on them or their practice. And in the next 30 minutes, you will have the pleasure of listening to American artist Nancy Lupo. Nancy will be taking us on a sort of a journey to Florence in Italy, and more specifically to the Pitti Palace, former home of the very notorious Italian banker family, the Medicis. In the Pitti Palace, Nancy finds a set of ivory objects turned on a lathe into the shape of cups, vases or trophies. These ivory objects are dated around 15th century and are all commissioned by the Medici family. This leads Nancy to contemplations on the material of ivory and on notions of soft power in the Renaissance versus today. Nancy Lupo is an artist who works primarily in sculpture. She currently lives in Los Angeles, where she also teaches at the UCLA. And as it was put somewhere about Nancy's work, more than panic, spiraling is something deeper. Telno Show is as always produced by me, Andreas Fyre from Institut von der Bakke, and Jan Høgestrikker from The Lake Radio in Copenhagen. I have nothing left to add except to pass on the microphone to Nancy Lupo.
I have no relationship to Ivory. You know, yeah, I have no relationship to it, but like, it's spooky as fuck. My name is Nancy Lupo. I am an artist. I identify as a sculptor, I think, and I write. I live in LA, but right now I've been in Florence for like the past month and I'm going back for another month. I'm working on an exhibition with my friend Monique Mouton, which we decided to title Destiny Cornucopia.
Welcome to the city of Dante, Machiavelli, and Michelangelo, and the place where Leonardo da Vinci learned how to paint.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about these ivory cups that I saw in Florence at this Pitti Palace, which was this palace where the Medicis lived and had their kind of base. And later, at some point, Napoleon lived there when he was on one of his missions to conquer. But anyway, now it's a museum, and it's amazing, actually, and sort of overwhelming.
In this room, we have got 7 paintings by Raphael. We have a very large painting by Rubens over here, and this is by Caravaggio.
This time, I'll take you in through the Pitti Palace and give you a brief walking tour.
It was the biggest palace in Europe until Versailles was constructed by Louis XIV. When Vittorio Emanuele II was the first king, this was his residence. So it's sort of like the White House of Italy as well, too. Today there's about 6 museums inside here, plus the gardens in the back that we'll be able to see when we get upstairs.
It was the Medici Palace, and it's right down from the Ponte Vecchio, which is this bridge. It's the only bridge in Florence that wasn't destroyed during World War II. And along the bridge, there are these shops. Now it's like a kind of jewelry district. Like it's like a gold market. It's the gold market in Florence. I mean, it's mostly for tourists, I guess, as is everything. But the Medicis did not build it. They bought it from some guy, Pitti, but lived there. And it is this gigantic stone palace. In the Pitti Palace, they have a lot of these like ebony cabinets, these like very, 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 very decorative woodwork and scroll work and like embedded precious stones. And you're like, wow, this is like some beautiful inlay or something. And then you look closer and it's like all the different colors of the inlay are rendered in these precious stones. And it's just like mind-blowing. And also these like crazy marble busts, you know, with this like insanely rendered hair, you know, like corkscrews and pasta. That could be another whole thing, just like the hair, the marble hair of this palace.
Now the next room is wonderful. Check this one out.
When you first walk in the door, there's this cabinet of crazy urns, maybe like a collection of urns. At first I thought maybe there was like dead people inside or like relics of saints or something like this. But later I went to the gift shop and found a postcard and it said that it was a cup. And so it was like, a cup? Like, what would you drink out of the cup?
This artifact is unique, but not isolated. It's one representative of a species of ivory oddity so exuberantly impractical, so elaborately absurd, that they appear, even in person, like spontaneous deformities of reality.
But in any case, I thought about it, and I did a Google search, and I think they were never used in any sort of functional sense because ivory stains, even if you, like, touch it with your fingers. So certainly you were not drinking, no one was drinking wine out of these, or even the blood of dead babies. So they were really just trophies. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about these objects that I saw at the Pitti Palace in Florence, like, last week or 2 weeks ago. They're turned, which I didn't really understand at the time, but they're turned on a lathe, and they're made from ivory, and that is another whole sort of probably very dark story. And they were just, like, really striking. I had never seen anything quite like this before. It was almost just like a kind of like visual dopamine hit or something. I don't think you can really legally fuck with ivory anymore, hopefully not. But they look kind of 3D printed. And what they are, which I guess I only really found out later, is well, they call them cups in some places, but I feel like they're really well described as, and also look like kind of trophies or something, you know, like these like incredibly ornate, like really decorative objects, this thing that pulls you into it with so much sort of like detail and intensity in these like little kind of corners and places, like a kind of cabinet of butterflies in like a natural history museum, you know, just like sort of spherical sculptures that are, like, at times it can, like, very irregular and very kind of like bulbous, and lots of these sort of like round shapes. Some of them look drunk.
Preternaturally strong, light, fine-grained, and homogeneous ivory is the only substance that can be carved in this manner. There is nothing else that can support such huge globes on such spindly legs or reach such translucency without cracking. It can be shaped to the thinness of paper or pierced to the intricacy of lace without falling apart. Because the lathe cuts in a circle, only a highly skilled turner could use it to carve eccentric, irregular shapes.
I mean, they can't all be turned out of like one piece of material. It must be also that there are certain details and decorations that are added on. So this one, I think, really makes you understand that when they're calling them cups, they're really not cups, because there's no way that this is actually a cup. Maybe you could say it's a lamp, but then it also does have psychedelic qualities of like a wine glass or something. Not a wine glass that you would ever use, just like a wine glass that you sort of like see and see through, but then also see reflections in and kind of trip out.
So I like the term psychedelic, even though it, and it's now accepted in biomedical literature, I like it, even though it's got all this 60s baggage associated with it, but it's the most accurate.
My favorite, yeah, this one that's like kind of doing a yoga pose or something. It's like on the very top is like a teeny tiny top, like a top that you spin, and that's attached right below to a kind of milk drop rendering. You know, this famous Edgerton photograph of the milk drop?
In the electrical engineering laboratory at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Professor H.E. Edgerton perfects a new high-speed movie camera, which shows the eye of man things that happen too quickly to be seen.
Attached to a kind of fatty, dripping lamp, and that's wide, like umbrella or sort of like mushroom wide, and then tapers down into like a kind of spire, and then there's this bulb-like glass area that's cloudy, starry. There's bubbles in the glass that make it like celestial in this way. And inside of the glass is this teeny tiny insanely rendered chandelier out of ivory, of course. So this kind of this like glass shape goes into a pedestal, and that looks sort of like Baroque candlestick. And like the bottom is like when someone's wearing a dress and they're like spinning around and it's caught in the air. And there's something about that, like in Baroque sort of rendering or fabric, or when I think about Bernini, that like it's all about the kind of like hypnosis of the fold.
Well, look at the way the wind seems to whip it around his body, creating this fabulous torsion in such contrast to the heavy quality of the cloth that she wears. She is of the earth, he is of the heavens.
And that also in contrast to the feathers that we can almost feel in his wings. Bernini is using marble, the same substance for all of these, but making them seem such different textures.
There's this other kind of like pleasure spectrum happening where like the longer that you look at it, you just like get caught in this kind of like hypnotic undulation of the fabric. And there's like the rounded part, and then there's like the fold. And I think in that hypnosis, like when you kind of like fall into that zone, it's like darker.
What do we have to do in there?
You will be required to look deep into the dreaded eyes of Iris, the great Egyptian magician.
Just looking at them, thinking about Louise Bourgeois sculptures, for example, that also kind of depict this like ascending spiral, or sort of like tower form or spiral form. When you look at them with that, it really kind of resonates. There's something really kind of like powerful about that sort of like extra logic of collaging or folding in addition to all of this kind of repetitive decoration.
By Osiris and by Apis, look at me. Look into my eyes. You have turned into a cat. By Osiris and by Apis, a cat.
There is something really decadent about these objects and the way that they sort of access this like super fantasy, imaginative desire and make it really like concrete. They're very sexy, I think we could say. When I saw these objects, it's like the first thing I had seen in a while, that almost kind of like a dopamine hit of visual information. Like it's really something I'd never seen before, but also is like, yeah, I guess it's like made on a lathe or has this kind of like machine aspect to it that's, I don't know, like maybe when you see this sort of universe of like 3D printed or CNC cut, computer aided rendering. I mean, even in architecture, right? Like there's these sort of towers in Shanghai. They couldn't be built without algorithms or the computer. Kind of Matthew Barney objects or something where it's just like so organic, like it's kind of made in a dream space or something. And the only way to really render that dream space in reality is like via some sort of computer. And so I think there is sort of like an analog in making, like this machine-aided making, along with the kind of like fantasy aspects of it. What are white things? Like the thing I feel like I come into contact with is like porcelain, like bone, like sugar, or like flour. I don't know, there's this universe of like bleached foodstuffs, like eggshells, milk. Already there's this like extremely kind of like animal, but not like the abject aspects of the animal, like the pristine, life-giving aspects of the animal that are white is a part of what makes them attractive and sort of terrifying.
The white whale tasks me. He heaps me.
I was thinking about in Moby Dick, this chapter called The Whiteness of the Whale. It's a shorter chapter than any other chapter and exists outside of the kind of like narrative drive of the book, and is just descriptions of the sort of like varying shades of white of the whale and how it's terrifying at times and sublime at times.
Though in many natural objects, whiteness refiningly enhances beauty, as if imparting some special virtue of its own, as in marbles, japonicas, and pearls, and though various nations have in some way recognized a certain royal preeminence in this hue, even the barbaric grand old kings of Pegu placing the title Lord of the White Elephants above all their other magniloquent descriptions of dominion, and the modern kings of Siam...
Everything is a found object, right? Which we would say also of like a tusk and marble and clay or any of these kind of like materials that we just consider materials. They're also like cultural objects that have like associative properties that whether you want it to or not stays with the object as it's like transformed or not over time. And I think sculpture is like about tapping into the kind of like of the latency of some of those things or some of those associations. They're extremely fantastical. Like you would think about Beauty and the Beast. You would think about all of these ultra, ultra, ultra elaborate, precisely rendered fantasies, which kind of leads into this other thing that they were made by princes. Like it was actually that these kind of Medici princes or whatever needed something to do, like a craft and a hobby. And like there could be a sports version of it, like polo or something, or like you should know a lot about wine or something like this. But so you know, you need to sort of do something. So they would learn how to do this kind of lathe turning. And so that's kind of interesting to think about fantasy or like the picturing of a kind of like fantasy world or like really, really ornate object that's sort of architectural that like proposes some like really extreme imaginative fantasy, and that's coming already like internally from these very privileged minds or something, I think is really important, like because how else. So I think that's kind of interesting, and probably that these also weren't really artworks. They were probably more like crafts. Like they were like really upper class kind of like craft objects.
Little town, it's a quiet village. Every day like the one before. Little town.
The Medicis, they're like bankers. I don't know if we would call them like middle class or what, but they're not nobles. They sort of like go from being these bankers and rise and rise and rise to really kind of legitimately joining the aristocracy, or at least like mixing in and marrying the aristocracy.
The wealth of the Medici family allowed them access to political power in Florence, even though they were not regarded as equals by the aristocracy, which made them all that more determined to gain power in any way that they could.
And then at some point, there's this real kind of turning point when they get one of the Medicis to be Pope.
Pope Leo just happened to be of the Medici family.
And then I think there are like several Medici popes, and like the papacy at this time is also like ultra kind of like corrupt and political. And I mean, I guess always, but I don't know, when you read about it historically, you're like, whoa, what? It all kind of like collides, but there's this movie called Queen Margot. It centers around Margot de Nevers, who's the daughter of Catherine de' Medici.
Catherine de' Medici was born on April 13, 1519, in Florence, Italy, to Lorenzo de' Medici, Duke of Urbino, and Madeleine de la Tour d'Auvergne, a relative of King Francis I of France. Lorenzo de' Medici was merely a commoner, but Madeleine was of noble birth, being the daughter of a count and duchess.
Okay, so it's Catherine de' Medici gets married into some sort of French nobility and eventually becomes the Queen of France.
Their marriage in 1518 was a political agreement between the king and Pope Leo X, who was head of the Catholic Church at the time.
But her husband was not really interested in her as a wife, which is like, I guess maybe sometimes that would happen where you'd be like, actually, like, I like you.
You're giving me the it's not you, it's me routine? I invented it's not you, it's me.
But most of the time it was just like transactional, and they were married for 10 years and in those 10 years didn't have a child, which is pretty dangerous for her.
Those who could not conceive were apt to raise suspicions of witchery because witches were understood to be in league with the devil, who could not generate life and so were infertile.
You know, if you don't have a kid, it's going to be over very quickly, but she did. And then had a couple, several of her sons became king, but she was always really kind of like scheming in the background, and had this kind of assassin who was her perfumer. And this guy is sort of like, in some histories, kind of credited as like the father of perfume.
Santa Maria Novella Pharmacy is thought to be the oldest apothecary in the world.
Maybe he was like a monk somehow, but somehow he's like associated with Santa Maria Novella, which was like this kind of like pharmacy, and then became this sort of perfumery, which is like common for like the operations of these monasteries.
Oh, very good one.
Pharmacy director Gianluca Foa says it dates back to 1221 when its Dominican monks began experimenting with alchemy.
But then eventually, you know, Santa Maria Novella became sort of what it is now, which is just like this sort of like magical ancient perfume house that still, I guess, produces this like Catherine de' Medici perfume that he made for her. Okay, so he did do that. He did really make perfume, but what he also made was like these poisons. So like a kind of lipstick that when you put it on and kiss somebody is like loaded with arsenic and they'll just like foam at the mouth and die immediately.
Catherine de' Medici was a woman of her times and a woman ahead of her time. She received an education far beyond what was considered respectable for a woman. And yet she came to be called the Serpent Queen, along with the Dark Queen, the Black Queen, and even the Queen of Poisons. Feel free to leave comments below to let me know what you think about Catherine de' Medici.
You know, you like study, I guess, the Renaissance a little bit in school and in some sort of like Western consciousness in a very expanded sense, all of these kind of like major works of art, the Botticelli, Birth of Venus, and Da Vinci, and Rubens, and Caravaggio, like it's all sort of like you just know what it is even though you really don't know what it is. And
here he's learning about geography, philosophy, the fine arts, the heavens, the universe is being explained to him by the muses.
Yeah, I like never really thought very much about the Renaissance until you kind of get there. And then all at once in a way, when you're sort of seeing these things, you're kind of like understanding this humanistic consciousness at this time. And like the constructing of this idea of like the refinement of the human being. The sort of aspiration of the Renaissance man, where you were like an artist and an inventor and a musician, and you were very charming and you were charismatic also. And in a way, I think like Lorenzo de' Medici really sort of like fixated on artists and used them as these ambassadors of sort of soft power and control for the way that they could slither between worlds and be these trickster characters and not behave by sort of aristocratic rules or bourgeois rules. They could kind of slide around and perform these different functions, perform, I don't know, like a kind of wildness or a sort of freedom or a kind of like refinement or some sort of like function of the imagination.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds.
And that's a function of like merchants, like money, like not aristocratic money, but just like business money, basic money, aspirational money, like trying to kind of build up power and influence and that art, but also really like the artist. Some of these like particular artists that do this turning, they're also making ballistics, like ammunition, you know, is like turned on the lathe, and also pyrotechnics, right? And that's something that Da Vinci was also like doing a lot for the Medicis, is like putting on like firework displays, you know, that was like something he was like commissioned to do a lot. And I don't know, it's like, it is very contemporary, right? If you think about Kanye or like Kim Kardashian or something, where it's like their sort of cultural soft power influence is unmatched.
We have all the time and all of the resources to burn them all to the ground.
Never go against the family.
Never go against the family.
You know, what do you do? And it's like, well, I left the house today wearing pants, boots, and like this superhero era or something is like embodied in these kind of pants, boots. Or I don't know, maybe like Balenciaga generally. It's like, what is it doing? Like, it's staging this sort of S&M clown show on Wall Street, you know, and that's like this really kind of like powerful particular mechanism to look at our contemporary moment in a way that's like operating in a much bigger cultural power moment than some other practices. Some people like deeply think that's art, and some people are just like, fuck that, that's not art. I don't know, but yeah, like that's the kind of like model of the Medicis. And also like one thing I realized is that Kim and Kanye were married in Florence. And I was like, makes sense.
To make sense. If something makes sense, it's easy to understand, it's clear. The first sentence in this essay just doesn't make sense. I can't understand it. Something sensible and reasonable, showing common sense. So what he said about the situation made sense, and I think he's probably right.
Yeah, I think it's like art power, but I think it's also like that it's spectacle and that it's kind of like celebrity driven and that it's sort of like that there are these like really specific artists, but like characters that were supported by the Medici and that they were kind of morally ambiguous characters, I think is really important. Freedom. And that's like the particular kind of like power and position that artists have and that like we want them to have. You want to see the artist sort of behaving badly or not following the rules of society the way that everybody else does, which is freedom, right? And that sort of like Caravaggio has this like very sort of like pornographic, like ultra fleshy, like universe that he's depicting. And then, you know, like Caravaggio is this like very kind of like goth, dark, sinister version of the same story. Or like Caravaggio's like next level character. That's also sort of what they were saying about Fra Angelico. It's like coming out of Gothic art. It's like the first sort of depictions of people that are like, that like you can see the kind of like heaviness of the emotion of being in the middle of like a kind of immaculate conception scenario. Like you're just sort of like, what the fuck? And that registers on your face. One of his famous paintings of Mary, there was like this dead woman, this, I don't know, probably prostitute or something that was like pulled out of the river. Her body was decomposing and swollen, and that this is the body that he used as a model for the Virgin Mary, which is like the ultimate psychotic punk move. Political also, right? Like it's like, this is the Virgin Mary. Yeah. I do think that there's just like, there's like this magnificent factor that I feel like has to be a part of these objects. And I feel like you see it in like partially in this kind of like miniatureness, you know, and like the impossibility of being able to use ivory in particular, because it was so strong, to be able to like render these teeny tiny little things, and you know, and that you would have the skill and also the material to be able to do that and create this overall kind of like thing that's just like stupefying and overwhelming and sublime. That's the kind of currency of these things, is like their magnificence, their amazingness. I'm interested in the way that things look, the way that you can trace the visual reason for an object to social conditions, economic conditions, political conditions, emotional conditions, conditions of desire. And I guess like when you're looking at an object like these cups, it's like, it's mostly speculative in a way, or you could just sort of like imagine the kind of like desire function. Like, I mean, in some ways that might not have even been cognizant to the people that are making them. These are objects like this where there's a lot of sort of like latent content, you know, it's like there's something happening on the surface in a very obvious way. Maybe they're, I mean, these are kind of commodity objects in a way, even though like their commodity-ness or status as tokens or trophies was operating differently than, say, a gazing ball spiral that I might be drawn to. I'm interested also in like the kind of like status of objects and the way that art potentially or and also inevitably kind of like intervenes in the trajectory of an object being kind of like seen and valued, but also just like visible. Like one of the classic moves of art is to like make something visible that's not so visible. And I think that visibility then sort of like triggers like this sort of psychic or emotional or spiritual sort of like, why is that though? Like, why as a culture, is this something that we needed or wanted or deserve? Like, what does that kind of like say about us in this moment that we're living in? And how is that kind of like beautiful and dramatic and maybe tragic or sort of pathetic?
Thank you all very much for listening. You have the last half an hour had the pleasure of listening to American artist Nancy Lupo talk to us about quite a lot of things, but all related to a set of ivory objects found in the Pitti Palace in Florence, former home to the Medici family. I would like to say thank you very much to Nancy for participating in this show. I'd also like to say thank you to the Arts Council of Denmark, Statens Kunstfond, and the Bikuben Foundation, Bikubenfonden, for support in making these programs. Talno Show is produced by me, Andreas Fyre from Institut Fonde Bakke, and Jan Høstrækker from The Lake Radio, and we wish you a very pleasant evening.
Sterreplaten extra.
Weird music isn't weird anymore, it's just music that exists.
Goedenavond en welkom bij Sterreplaten. We gaan vandaag vrijkaarten weggeven, maar we gaan beginnen met Billy Woods natuurlijk. Het is onvermijdelijk. De beste man pers er nog eentje uit op zijn Backwoods label. En het heet Go We Look, een soort van herinterpretatie van het materiaal van zijn album van eerder dit jaar, van Op Gollywalk. Dat tezamen met August Fannin. Die zwermt al een heel tijdje rond Backwoods, maar heeft eigenlijk nog nooit iets uitgebracht samen met Billy zelf. Tot nu dus. Hier is een nummer van op Gobbylook. Let Pain Test van August Fannin en Billy Woods. Thoughts was possessed since the first day of birth. Thoughts was possessed since the first day of birth. The first day of birth.
Hold my breath if I walk past on a visit. They replastered the last crooked paths of the lizards. My uncle is the ghost of Thanksgiving past. First floor front room Mars was the last to get the message. Now it's just tenants. Y'all wasn't here when the bandos was brick skeletons. Mars gathered like migrational change. Miguel pigeon coop feathers kept breaking the drains. These ain't pains, these the regular aches. My mom's slave cause she said ownership was breaking the chains. Me and my father's main ball was that day we cursed our pigs at our gate. Every black life a thriller. Even an infant if the infamil don't kill her. Pages turn Ezra Jack Keats to iller fates. Arthur Miller home was based to beat in the chase. From toes tagged in the chiller. Now walk past my own door. No welcome homes from the shivers. Forgiveness like the cold wind. Old men remember.
Let the children come. Let your mother hear you laugh.
Half crushed by the car, dragged herself back and caterwauled. Father put out her misery on the kitchen floor. Mom said be proud of her, she made it home. If these walls could talk, they might not after all we don't. One door been locked since when, why is never said, but we know. We know. I left that house for two rooms, but it got a peephole. I ain't been back since then, but kids still see ghosts. I'm not my ancestors' dreams. They in the room wishing they could smoke and eat. Lean shadows, dust swirling, the sunbeam shadows reach for my son in dreams. Some shadows air deep, shadowing me. Crossing that threshold again, they gon' part like the sea. Solemnly pointing to that room, but I swear to the Lord, I never had the key. Somehow it's in my hand now, that brass turned green. Grass dead in the yard, Philistines chopped down the avocado tree. I put my ear to the door, but all I could hear was my heartbeat.
God bless this sweet home, my beloved heart. 1, 2, 4, Bluestone crouched on thin heart. God bless this sweet home, my beloved heart. 1, 2, 4, Bluestone crouched on thin heart.
We all got a home on that rock, yeah, it won't be long. Sisters, hold on. Grandma still singing that freedom song. When I close my eyes, I can hear a moan. We made our own language, black woman blues technology. Improvise with the lessons, participate in our own resurrection. You can't kill us, we built like ghosts coming out of dust, always returning. Built like the star of the morning, sharpening swords to strike through the heart of the morning. Sun go through hell like a morning run, blues blood like a love supreme. I'm the dream of my sisters, oh happy day. When Jesus washed the blood away on the concrete that day, the devil had to pay. Am I crazy to write this? Am I crazy? They try to slay me, and I'm really from around the way. Inventions and innovations, Washington Park projects. We engineer black women as reparations, and all y'all gon' pay for all the years we had to wait on hands and knees, washing blood off the display, shoveling all the death and decay while people screaming, "Stay in my corner." I'm like, let the referee say fight. It's fight night, bitch. My mama used to play the Dells. See you in hell.
Let Pain Test van August Fannin en Billy Woods. Ja, Mormother doet natuurlijk ook mee op dat album Gobbylook. En ook Armand Hammer, natuurlijk ook nieuw album. We gaan Sudan Archives draaien, derde album van Sudan Archives. Deze, de BPM, komt uit op Stone Throw, beïnvloed door techno en house, maar eigenlijk vooral een eigenzinnige en vooral een heel kleurrijke visie op R&B, Dead van Sudan Archives. Dead van Sudan Archives van op de BPM, nieuwe album. En het is een goeie natuurlijk. Ze doet trouwens ook mee op het volgende album. Dat is een compilatie van Soul Jazz. Een soort van project met allemaal vrouwelijke artiesten. En die roteren eigenlijk per nummer een heel album lang. MC Yala doet bijvoorbeeld mee, Dubmaster, Yaya B. En wij gaan iets draaien van Dubbing Sun en Blue Hill featuring Warrior Queen. Hier is Armageddon.
End of days, I'm getting in time, no time for lazy.
Gonna see.
Time to focus and clean up without your ways.
Every
and
time.
To the Father, we give thanks and praise.
Every
it
time.
Is embrace. We say the vibes we have one worldwide, say just now go cease.
I saw me see it.
I'm a getting in time right now, wickedness I increase. Who don't see? So just at attention and